From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a comparison of the lead crisis in Milwaukee with what the city of Flint faced, from a journalist with a new book on Flint.
Then, 10 years ago, a huge investment was launched in three Milwaukee neighborhoods. What has the legacy of that work been a decade on?
There is a really engaged and energized group of residents in every neighborhood, and that is making their lives so much better.
And our film contributors look back at the last 12 months' worth of movies and try to figure out the overarching trends.
We sometimes, as a world, take a couple steps forward, and art sometimes leads the way, but then take a couple steps backward, and so we're still all a work in progress, and I think that includes Hollywood.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. It has been several years since Milwaukee health officials first sounded the alarm about the lead content in the water of many homes in the city. But this is not the only city that's had to confront the problem.
Most notoriously, it was Flint, Michigan, which really put the lead issue into the national consciousness. Michigan journalist Anna Clark recently wrote a book about the crisis, and she was in Milwaukee last week to talk about it in a series of lectures at Marquette University.
Lake Effect's Susan Benz spoke with Clark about her research and how it might benefit other cities, including Milwaukee. Clark began by describing some of the Flint residents that influenced her writing.
One of the things that has haunted me is how much uncertainty people feel to this day. Like when they look back over their experiences, there's a lot that is never going to be known. So, you know, if somebody was giving water to their kids and one of their kids in, you know, a few years starts having serious developmental delays, is that going to was that caused by the water? Was it would it happen anyway? They never really know. One of the leading figures in the Flint story, her name's Leanne Walters, and two of her kids were twins. They had been growing up pretty much exactly in sync. They were fraternal twins, but, you know, hitting the same metrics. They had had lead tests when they were younger. And one of them had a compromised immune system. He was more vulnerable. And he started, she described it as like, you know, he was like forgetting words that she was sure he knew. His growth started slowing. The other one started passing him up. I mean, she could clearly see that something else was going on here. And as later tests eventually showed, he was lead poisoned. And they did have a really genuinely astonishing amount of lead, like way out of proportion, even for the city, others homes in the city. And another one of her children, he was a teenager, he was having like severe abdominal pains. He had like visited the hospital, he'd missed school. There was some talk whether he should go on a pre-planned trip to visit his father on the other side of the state. They decided to, we're just going to do it. And when he left town, his symptoms disappeared. I mean, it's a lot, you know, and I think the way this water crisis manifested, it just showed up in a lot of different forms for people's lives. Like a problem that might have showed up may or may not have been caused by the water, but the fact that it could be and we'll never know for sure is part of the permanent legacy of this water crisis.
So during your presentation, Anna, you mentioned that Flint and Milwaukee share some common there's some commonalities there. What are some of those things?
Sure. Well, they're mid-sized Great Lakes cities. They are blessed by being in a region that has some of the most abundant freshwater resources on the face of the earth. They are cities that have been shaped both economically and culturally by its industrial past. They are cities that were changed dramatically by the Great Migration in the 20th century and in similar ways, where it came a little bit later than it did for Detroit and Chicago. They also, I think, have a strong history of organizing. You know, there is a strong culture passed down, I think, from generations of people who have learned how to make themselves visible when there are things that they think are wrong.
So we're also extremely segregated city.
Yes. Segregation, right? And this is part of the pattern. This is what is the roots of infrastructure inequality in America? This is literally when we said some property is worth less because of the color of the skin or the ethnicity of the people who live in it. That was made explicit in our local, state, and federal policies. It took an enormous amount of effort to get those laws off the books. But as we can see, we still live, our societies, if anything, more segregated than it used to be. Why is that? First of all, the patterns are in place. They perpetuate themselves. You know, people pass their houses down to their kids. They're more likely to sell houses to people who look like them. There's been a rise of exclusionary zoning that has taken the place of explicit segregation laws, but has the same effect. So like communities might ban multifamily housing or not do developments with Section 8 vouchers are allowed, things that are correlated with race and in fact, you know, do have the effect of making communities more homogeneous. These patterns of so-called separate and equal didn't work then, and they don't work now. And until there is some more affirmative response to dismantling that, we are going, I believe, to continue to see its consequences in our communities. In other words, that people of color are dangerously more vulnerable to certainly public health crises, but also to all the kinds of loss of opportunity you get when you set certain geographical regions up to fail. You decided this particular area is, if not officially redlined anymore, it's effectively redlined. And that's what I think, even though the city of Flint still has like 40% white people, it's actually less, it's more white than I think people think it is. It's coded as a black city now. And so therefore it as a whole has been denied the same kind of like resources, opportunity, support, assumption of credibility, their voting rights that other communities might take for granted.
I don't know how much you've looked at Milwaukee's situation. We have not faced the crisis that Flint has, obviously. But I think through that crisis in Michigan, it's brought more attention here where we have 70,000 plus lead lateral lines. Do you have any observations on what you've heard about or talked with others about in Milwaukee, anything that strikes you in terms of the danger of lead?
Sure. I definitely followed it, not super closely, so I don't want to pretend to be an expert on it. But first of all, Milwaukee is ahead of the game in certain ways. Like the fact that they are talking about lead, there is this pretty much unanimous acknowledgement that lead is in fact a problem. That's more than most people are doing nowadays, even in the wake of Flint. I think a lot of folks would prefer to see it as a singular crisis, or are still rationalizing ways that, oh, maybe it's not that bad, or maybe it's fine if it's in this, you know, at least Milwaukee has like acknowledged that. Now it's in that like really fraught place of what do we do to get rid of it and how do we prioritize getting rid of it. One thing that makes me sad, frankly, as I understand in Milwaukee, there's a lot of dissent among whether we're focusing on lead paint or lead laterals and lead in the water. Both of these are important. Lead intake is cumulative. All of it is bad. I support both getting rid of the lead paint and the lead laterals. And lead that's in the soil. It's a result of, among other things, our long relationship with leaded fuel. But I would hope that the advocates for each of these can find ways to like synchronize. Some folks I talked to while working on the book have thought about like if you have to, for example, step into someone's home to hook up a new non-lead pipe, what if that's also an opportunity to do an audit, you know, of other sources of lead in the house? What if it's not just a community has to choose between are we going to tackle lead paint first or lead pipes? What if it's one common effort? Can we find a way to do that? I know there's a number of practical challenges to doing that, but if done appropriately, not only could it be more effective, it could also, in the long term, be more economical.
One of the things that you mentioned in your talk was that just figuring out exactly who the people are who were culpable in Flint, and you threw out the idea that it's difficult for people to acknowledge that they've made a mistake, yeah, that they were wrong. How much do you think that figures into the kind of things that happen in Flint and in could other places?
I mean, it's enormous. I mean, I think it's like, that's a huge factor of just what's happened in the community over the last few years. I think it's also gets back at some of those longer problems. We haven't, you know, we have this pretense of living in a colorblind society nowadays, but in fact, it's not. And, you know, and I think the difficulty in acknowledging what is right in front of us relates a little bit to that instinct to that denialism and difficulty in handling personal accountability for our role in a society that is set up to be unfair. And especially those of us, including myself, who benefit from it. Like I have unearned advantages because of the color of my skin. And that feels bad, you know? And so in acknowledging that in a proactive way, in an affirmative way, in a, just a direct, straightforward way, isn't easy, you know? It's hard. The baggage of the past is like right at our heels. There are things I'm not personally responsible for that nonetheless I have to kind of answer to. I think the sooner more of us can do that, the sooner we're going to have healthier, safer, more inclusive communities for everybody. Yeah, and I like to think that if we can learn how to do that on like smaller scales, like within neighborhoods, within a city, within a particular environmental agency, we could start learning how to scale this up. Because one thing we've learned with both racism and with lead is that it doesn't go away by just pretending it's not there.
So dipping back to your point that the sources of lead are all important and dangerous to particularly young children, do you think it would benefit the effort in pushing through to solutions, to remediation, to consider lead a public health emergency?
I do think lead is a public health emergency. I understand the reluctance to put it in those terms because there's so much lead. I think there's a lot of folks who fear just spreading like just mass hysteria, you know? We don't want to send the message that you should never drink tap water. We don't want to give up on public drinking water systems. We don't want to like give up on the older legacy cities that have a disproportionate amount of lead in them, you know? We don't want to give up on the people who have already been affected by this. But I don't think it's an either or situation. I think that there's a way to acknowledge that this is a priority. It only gets worse the longer we deny that. The sooner we can start tackling it with the seriousness that it deserves, the sooner we're going to be better off. We just are. And we don't have to totally start from scratch. It seems so daunting, but like the fact that we have public drinking water systems in the first place is a testament to how people can tackle ridiculously hard situations and succeed, you know? Like drinking water systems, it was such a patchwork, difficult, trial and error process. No one formula worked for all communities. Everybody had different geographies and different source water supplies. It took a while to figure out that not just delivering the water, but treating it was important, and that not just rich people who could pay for a sort of separate supply were going to, that wasn't going to work, you know, for the civic good. All people needed access to clean, safe water, and that was good for the economic growth of our cities as well. Great. That was done. And then I think we kind of like just coasted and we got to the point where we were able to take it for granted. And in some ways that's beautiful. I want people to take clean, safe water for granted in the sense that it should be so available, it's almost invisible. But as stories like Flint and a lot of what's happening in Milwaukee, you know, kind of show that you can't, that there's a limit to that. It does, we need to think about our water more ecologically. Like it things happen in cycles. We got to keep, you know, vigilant with it. We got to continue in relationship with it. We got to learn, you know, like use our growing knowledge. If we tackle lead as a public health emergency, I don't think that means everybody needs to be alarmed and go on a solely bottled water diet. But I do think it means profound investment in drinking water infrastructure of the likes that hasn't been seen in like a century. And I think it means finding ways to sync this up with the lead paint that is not just in homes, but in older schools and all kinds of buildings all over the country and in our soil.
I heard you speak in Flint when I went to a conference there. Oh, no. And you talked about children having been used as incubators. Mm. That just struck me to the core.
Right? I mean, this is like, and this is as it gets, among things we can do if we start taking this seriously is look at like what our federal policies are. And we do have some our policies that regulate lead in drinking water have a lot of loopholes in them. Though no amount of lead is safe, they essentially say they don't, there's no maximum limit for any one particular home. There's like no real process to clarity about how to like remove the lead. You know, there's a number of problems. As in Flint, it's children's bodies that are the metric for whether or not we're going to take it serious. In other words, these kids have to get sick before anybody is going to do something about it. That's not good enough. I think we as a society can do better than that. Like, what if we took care of this problem before it caused permanent incurable damage to an entire city, the next generation of an entire city? Like, what if we did that? I think that is a much more rational and humane way of approaching our drinking water than waiting to see if there's so much lead in the water or from other sources in the city that these small developing bodies are harmed.
Anna Clark is a Michigan-based journalist. Her recent book is called The Poison City, Flint's Water and the American Urban Tragedy. She was in Milwaukee last week to speak at Marquette University, and she chatted with Susan Bentz then.
We will take a quick break, and then a Milwaukee reporter looks at the impact of a major initiative on three neighborhoods after 10 years. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM. We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. 10 years ago, the city of Milwaukee, like the rest of the country, was trying to dig out from a crippling recession. The financial crisis, along with the ongoing deindustrialization of the upper Midwest, seemed to portend a rocky future for already challenged neighborhoods in Milwaukee.
And while the ensuing decade has not been an easy time, to say the least, three neighborhoods in particular saw their fortunes change through a major investment from the Milwaukee-based Zilber Family Foundation. The project was called the Zilber Neighborhood Initiative.
Reporter Andrea Waxman set out to quantify the initiative's impact on its three neighborhoods for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. In the interest of full disclosure, she notes the same foundation also provided significant funding for the online publication. Andrea Waxman, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Mitch. It's nice to be here again.
Nice to have you back. It's been a while.
It has.
Let's take a step back and talk about what the initiatives were about in the first place and why they focused on the three neighborhoods that they did.
Yes, that's an interesting story. So Joseph Zilber was a philanthropist who grew up in Milwaukee. He was the son of poor Russian Jewish immigrants who owned a grocery store. His family lived above the grocery store at approximately 10th and Meineke in what is now called the Lindsay Heights neighborhood. So Mr. Zilber went on to earn a fortune in the real estate industry. And towards the end of his life, I think he was nearing 90 years old, he returned to his old neighborhood, the story goes, and was really distressed to see how much it had declined from the time that he grew up there. He felt that even though he had been poor, he had been given a lot of opportunities from the community and the city, and he could see that that wasn't really true for the children now who live there now, and he wanted to do something about that, and he decided to dedicate a large sum of money to something that was eventually called the Zilber Neighborhood Initiative. He also had relationships with nonprofit organizations in the city because he had been doing philanthropy for a while, but he really wanted to do this big effort to dedicate the money and the skills that he could bring to bear with that money to revitalize these neighborhoods that had been hit really hard by waves of economic disinvestment and displacement. So he went to a woman named Susan Lloyd, who was doing this kind of work in Chicago. She worked on several really big projects with the MacArthur Foundation there. One of them was called New Communities, and it was similar to what she and the Zilber Family Foundation eventually did in Milwaukee. In Chicago, I think they focused on 14 neighborhoods, and I think they actually had the same amount of money that were dedicated to a much smaller number of neighborhoods in Milwaukee. He dedicated $50 million and hired Susan Lloyd away from Chicago and got her to move here to head up this effort.
And presumably $50 million can have a fairly substantial impact in just three neighborhoods.
True, although money never goes as far as
right.
you want it to.
Part of it was about leveraging other dollars,
Absolutely.
Though, right?
Absolutely, and that is one of the things that Susan Lloyd and the Zilber Family Foundation did very well. They actually ended up investing more than $50 million, but they also leveraged more than that and ended up with, I think the latest estimate was $111 million. So I guess I should say the neighborhoods, the first two neighborhoods that were chosen, Lindsay Heights and Clark Square, Lindsay Heights on the north side and Clark Square on the south side, were selected because there were strong nonprofit organizations embedded in those communities that had been working there for a long time, that were trusted by the residents, and that had already strong neighborhood involvement.
So the potential was there.
Absolutely. I mean, they didn't have to spend years and years building up something that these two organizations had already done, and those were in Lindsay Heights, Walnut Way Conservation Corps, which was started by Sharon and Larry Adams and their neighbors.
Sure.
They actually started Walnut Way in 2000 when Sharon Adams returned to the neighborhood that she grew up in after going to college and having a career in the East in New York. So she returned. She saw her family home and street and neighborhood in bad condition and decided she was going to do something about it.
Not unlike Joseph Zilber and his approach.
That's really interesting. Yes, absolutely. In Clark Square, there was an organization called Journey House, and they built a community center called Journey House that connects with the largest public school in the state, Longfellow School. And Joe Zilber had been working with them for some years and knew Dr. Michelle Bria, who is the head of Journey House. And then later,
Layton Boulevard West, right?
Right. Another nonprofit called Layton Boulevard West Neighbors, which was started by the School Sisters of St. Francis in response to declining conditions in the neighborhoods that surrounded them on Layton Boulevard. There are really three neighborhoods there, but the Zilber Neighborhood Initiative thought, you know, kind of considered it a third neighborhood. Their executive director at the time, Charlotte John Gomez, actually came to Zilber and said, you know, we are just the kind of neighborhood that you're looking for. If you're going to add one, please consider us. She had been working with Clark Square, which is right next door, participating in some of the planning and things over there. And so it was just really an extension west for ZNI to include LBWN. But John Gomez and her and the residents in the LBWN neighborhoods were really doing a lot of good work, especially around housing.
Well, and so in the end, what is the legacy of this 10 years of effort and dollars leveraged in these three comprehensive neighborhoods?
Well, it's really a multifaceted picture, of course, and it is also ongoing, and I'm sure that Zilber will continue to be involved. But one reason that I wrote the story now is that the commitment was for 10 years, and the 10 years ended at the end of 2018. So all of the series of planning efforts that took place kind of culminated at the end of this time. Also, Susan Lloyd, the executive director, decided to step down, and her successor, Gina Stilp, took over in July, but there's been a little bit of overlap for the rest of the year. In Lindsay Heights, when Sharon Adams came back, the appearance of the neighborhood was depressing everyone. There had been so many jobs lost with the deindustrialization, particularly there in the 90s. So they focused on housing and economic development in Lindsay Heights. I think they would mostly say that the most dramatic project that they completed was the Innovation and Wellness Center. Mm-hmm. It's right on North Avenue and 16th, between 16th and 17th. There's an old brick building there that used to be a nightclub. It's been vacant for years. They undertook to raise millions of dollars to renovate this building, and they completed stage one of the building 3 years ago, and they are going to build a new building, which is expected to be completed in the third quarter of this year. The Innovations and Wellness Center focuses on business development and also health and wellness, which are two big focuses of the residents in Lindsay Heights and Walnut Way are trying to do and are doing. So in that brick building, there is a business called the Juice Kitchen, which is both a business for residents and run by residents, and it's also contributing to healthy eating. And there is the Milwaukee Center for Independence has a commercial kitchen there, so their clients work. I think they make lunches for Milwaukee Public Schools, among other things, and I believe that that commercial kitchen is available for entrepreneurs during the time that MCI is not using it. And then the Fondy Food Center has their administrative offices upstairs on the second floor. And when it opened, Outpost Natural Foods had a small store. It was kind of a pop-up experiment. They decided to
I think
close
it's now like
it.
A cooler cabinet or something within
well,
the Juice Kitchen.
They use it as a, for up until really recently, they used it as a kind of learning space so different people could rent it. We actually had a program there, a panel discussion. So it was a community space that you could rent and, you know, for events and markets and things. But lately, a little group of entrepreneurs have moved in and have businesses there. So I know there's a clothing store. So one of the things they've tried to do in Lindsay Heights is really help residents figure out how to have their own businesses because employment was such a problem.
What are some of the lasting legacies that you were able to see in both Clark Square and Layton Boulevard West?
Okay. Clark Square, the Journey House project is really a huge project. It's really what they call the hub of the neighborhood, the heart of the neighborhood.
This includes the football field, is that right?
The football field is a project of theirs. It's actually in Mitchell Park.
Okay.
The football field was given to them by, donated to them by the Green Bay Packers. And in Clark Square, there is a lot of emphasis on youth development because, you know, partly there are just so many kids. And there's lots and lots of emphasis on youth development of all kinds, but particularly athletic. And the Journey House, though, does so many things. They have all kinds of adult education. They have citizenship and English as a second language. The neighborhood is about 70% Hispanic and about 15% white. And then the rest of it, the population there is Asian American, Native American, and other groups. Right. The CSNI part of it, the Clark Square Neighborhood Initiative, is kind of taken over helping people with maintaining their houses, trying to increase home ownership, focusing on public safety and also economic development of Cesar Chavez Drive, which has the residents in CSNI have brought a lot of art and culture as well as economic development. It's an important focus for them. They've established a lovely bronze statue of Cesar Chavez himself, and through that they are teaching the young people about the Latino civil rights and labor movements. I mentioned in my story that probably the biggest problem the neighbors see in their neighborhood, is Clark Square neighborhood, is a continuation of some crime and prostitution, particularly on Greenfield Avenue. Greenfield was just resurfaced. It was a really big project. It was not just patching. It was repaving.
Similar to North Avenue going through the Lindsay Heights neighborhood.
The two are really about the prettiest streets in the city now. They're brand new, North Avenue and Greenfield Avenue. So when that project was going on, it was lengthy and it displaced some of the prostitution, and the neighbors have been with CSNI have been working really hard on that. It really disrupts life there. So they've succeeded in working. One of the residents gave me an example of how this activity was going on at a McDonald's in the neighborhood. They went and they talked to the management, and they worked some things out that improved the situation. So the neighbors in all of these neighborhoods, the residents are very, very engaged. And that is really part of the strategy of all of these organizations, is not only to develop physical things, but to kind of revitalize the connections between people, because the things that have gone on in these disinvested neighborhoods have really disrupted the fabric of community. And so involving the neighbors not only allows them to have agency over the changes that they want to see, it also helps them build relationships with each other.
And with that in mind, I know the Layton Boulevard West Neighbors organization has historically been a strong one. What has the impact of the investment from the Zilbert Neighborhood Initiative meant to that organization and that neighborhood?
Well, one of the things, probably the main thing, is that they have very beautiful houses. And when the School Sisters of St. Francis started to see a kind of disinvestment that happened in those other neighborhoods, beginning there, they really decided to try to address it and slow it down, and it never really got quite as bad in these three neighborhoods. They are called Silver City, which is west of 27th and south of Pierce, mm-hmm. and then right below that is Burnham Park, and then Layton Park are the three neighborhoods that are kind of lumped together in the term Layton Boulevard West Neighbors. So they had a project called Turnkey Homes, and this started even before Zilber came in, but the Zilber money helped them really take it, scale it up. And it involved taking foreclosed and empty houses and really marketing them and improving them, buying them, fixing them up, bringing people to go on tours to see the homes that were available, talking with the people in the neighborhood about talking to their friends and relatives about these homes. And they really stabilized this kind of moving out and abandoning homes and things that was going on through this Turnkey Homes project. And so their focus is also on health and education and youth and all of those things that everybody needs to have a healthy life and a happy neighborhood and community. But because of the situation with the houses and the availability of the houses, that's probably been the project that's had the most impact.
And in the end, the 10 years is up, but it sounds like in all three neighborhoods that are part of this initiative, there's plenty of work left to be done.
There is, and there is a really engaged and energized group of residents in every neighborhood, and that is making their lives so much better. Susan Lloyd said to me, living in poverty can be very isolating, and this just brings back a sort of set of connections and a fabric of a community that is very powerful and will continue to. These residents will have taken things into their own hands.
Well, it is a great story, and Andrea Waxman, thank you so much for telling it.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure to be here again.
Andrea Waxman is a reporter with the online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. You'll find a link to her series on the Zilber Neighborhood Initiative at WUWM.com.
We will take one more break, and then our film contributors convene to look back at some of the best movies and some notable movie trends from the past year. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. There were hundreds of films released in 2018, but with awards season in full swing, it can be hard to remember any of them that aren't being talked about in terms of the Oscars. Well, thankfully, we have film contributors who can remind us of some of the highlights from the past year, whether they're award-winning or not.
Ryan Jay and Dave Lurson joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio to share their top picks, filmmaking trends, and the increasing competition between television and film. Ryan Jay begins with his observation of the year in film.
I think 2018 was one of the most exciting years. It didn't seem to be the way as we entered it. And even around summertime, you didn't really, the films that were going to become awards-worthy campaign films weren't really on the radar yet. So we didn't know how it was all going to shape up. But even early in the year, there were favorites.
And how about you, Dave?
Well, I thought the year got off to a bit of a slow start with some good releases along the way. I was kind of worrying, in fact, by September, October, okay, where is the big onslaught of Oscar nomination-worthy films? I kind of hoped that the Spike Lee movie would make it, and indeed it did in the end. That was a summertime release, as I recall. I liked Black Panther a lot early in the year. Disobedience was really good, and that, I believe, was wintertime. So there were some of these good things that came out early in the year. But to me, a long stretch, at least in the multiplexes, of really, really, you know, subpar stuff.
Yeah, it was a bit slow to start. And then, of course, as it usually goes, these past couple months have been the onslaughts of Oscar nomination releases. But before we get into those, I would like to touch upon trends. So one thing I noticed for sure this past year is that Netflix is getting much stronger with releases. And of course, we have the first Netflix-produced film nominated for Best Film Oscar. And we had a few Amazon series and movies being released just outside in a normal theater, not even exclusively for Prime. So do you think that this is going to change the competition from here on out?
It's another factor as far as what gets released into movie theaters around the country. It's also another reason, I'm sorry to say, to stay home and watch great things in the comfort of your living room or your bedroom because, I mean, this is truly a golden age of TV. The golden age of television was not I Love Lucy in 1957 or whatever, and it's fine, whatever. But, I mean, there's never been such an enormous number of really superb television programs, whatever that even means, stuff for the screen. I mean, I think we need to redefine what we're talking about at some point here. But, I mean, there's plenty of stuff to do right at home. This was the year where I finally began accessing Amazon Prime and Netflix. I've been a holdout, a Luddite a little bit in that area. And, well, you know, I've had a great time watching things at home. And up until the last couple of months, I was not having as good of a time consistently in movie theaters.
Right. It says something when you can't even get the three of us to a movie theater consistently.
I think what we're really seeing here is a paradigm shift in the entertainment industry because we are blurring the lines between television and film, and it started with casting. It was HBO luring big, you know, huge Academy Award winning actors and actresses to the small screen, then networks doing it, and now Netflix and Amazon, and the blurring of the line between streaming and television. There used to be a really high prestige factor and a difference between being an actor who does film or does TV, and it meant something. It doesn't anymore. It is as prestigious to do television, arguably even a viral web episode could be as important to one's career as doing an award-nominated performance on the big screen in a film. So, yes, what's following then is Netflix and Amazon becoming theatrically distributed studios, not just streaming services. And it is huge. It is changing entertainment and arguably the world because the way that influencers are responding and how we're perceiving. The one thing I want to disagree with Dave, though, is I still think it's, especially with big movies like the Netflix-nominated Best Picture, Roma, which I did not like, and I don't know anyone else who didn't, so I will take it as the minority member of that opinion. But it's still, I'd argue it's still better on the big screen.
I would agree with you, though, actually, because from an aesthetic standpoint, I love big screens. There are plenty of movies that have been released in the past 20 years or so where it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. But a great film, even if it's not a great film story-wise, but a great film visually, it really demands to be seen in that kind of format. It is shrunk looking. It's kind of like looking at Picasso's Guernica in an art history book with the image, you know, reduced to some small little thing on the top of a page. Yeah, you see what it looks like, but you're not getting the full picture.
Right, and when you're watching something at home, you're tempted to pause, you're tempted to stop and you finish it on another day, you're tempted to look at your phone, run to the bathroom, stop and make some food. You don't get the community aspect of a theater experience. You don't necessarily get the best surround sound and those sorts of things. So I still argue that, you know, to see a director's real vision, especially if we're looking at an award-worthy type film, it's always better on the big screen.
The Black Panther movie not only was historic in its release in early 2018, but now it's having even a bigger resurgence. You call it a boomerang effect, however you'd like it, but people are still paying attention. People are still talking about it. So what was it about this film? You know, for one, it was a refreshing superhero movie in a market that's oversaturated with them. But to you both, what stood out with Black Panther? And do you think that it will hold its momentum that it has going and actually get some awards?
Well, I think it's going to continue the momentum toward African-American filmmaking, toward African-Americans playing a more prominent role in Hollywood. It shows there's an enormous audience for movies that are, it's not an all-black cast movie, but a movie that's largely African-American in casting. One thing that I liked about this movie, in addition to the fact that the complexion of the lead characters, the heroes, was different than it normally would be. But there was a sense of the power of community in this film as opposed to the power of one guy or one woman or some little group of people band together to save the universe. Here you had an entire nation, as it were, working together to fend off their enemy. And I think that there is a lesson that's very important that we might want to take from that.
I think when we're talking about Black Panther, it's important to also recognize a film like Crazy Rich Asians in 2018 and talk about diversity in general and, you know, also gender, you know, more female cinematographers and directors and screenwriters and the effort of actresses primarily like Nicole Kidman who are taking a stand and saying that they're going to work with every 18 months female directors and other people, you know, making proclamations like that. It's a really important thing for diversity that our art reflects who we are as a world, as an audience, because it's important for us, whether a story is a good story, anyone can relate to it, but we still want to identify with the characters that we see.
Yeah, and some of the other movies that kind of fall in that purview in particular, we had a lot of quality LGBTQ cinema releases this year. So most notably, Love, Simon was the first kind of popular, widely released film centered around a gay teenager. And then we have Disobedience. Rachel Weisz had two strong films in that and in The Favorite this year. We have Colette, Miseducation of Cameron Post, and Boy Erased, two films about conversion therapy. And Can You Ever Forgive Me, Bohemian Rhapsody, and The Favorite. So with LGBTQ cinema, we have more black filmmakers and actors. We have Crazy Rich Asians. Do you hope that this momentum will continue to carry through? And did you have any special favorites of any that I listed?
I have favorites among many of the movies you just mentioned. But I think, again, one of the most remarkable turnarounds in my lifetime is the changing attitude towards sexuality. 25 years ago, it would have been very inconceivable to think about what we're talking about right now. And all over the place on television programs, there's more and more of a matter-of-factness about somebody's sexuality. It's not a major plot point necessarily. The gay man is not necessarily the villain anymore. I mean, it is so different than it was years ago. I mean, a movie like Bohemian Rhapsody, for example, there have been films throughout the history of Hollywood about gay or bisexual stars, and up until pretty recently, this would have been cloaked in some way, encoded perhaps, or ignored entirely. And now, you know, large numbers of people will go out and see this. And
it's made almost $1 billion worldwide now.
Yeah, I don't know, I suppose there's some, you know, fringe group somewhere complaining about it, but basically it's not a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is. I remember when I saw, as a member of the LGBTQ community myself, I remember seeing Love, Simon and thinking about how different my life might have been had I seen that when I was of the age that the characters in that film, because it was such a natural, real, it mirrored all the movies that I did grow up with but couldn't actually identify with because they were all straight characters. So that movie was incredibly powerful to me, as were many of the other films that you mentioned. But we still look at the world then, you know, which were recently the Supreme Court upheld a ban on transgender people in the military. So you know, it's like we sometimes as a world take a couple steps forward and art sometimes leads the way, but then take a couple steps backward. And so we're still all a work in progress. And yeah. I think that includes Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to review what our best films of 2018 were, do you both have a few select favorites? And by all means, if you have any worst films,
yeah,
mention those.
I do. And I'll preface it by saying these are favorites. And to assess best, you're getting into cosmic matters of truth here. But I will say that my favorite film of the year was Bohemian Rhapsody. I think it was a historically condensed and simplified, of course. But I very much relate to this movie. I'm a person of that time. I was involved in music. The family situation of Freddie Mercury was very much like my own family. So I personally related to it. I also found it to be extremely entertaining, great music. And it certainly, you know, reached a very large audience.
I am so in the minority this year. My favorite film of the year was probably the worst reviewed film across the board. Welcome to Marwen by Robert Zemeckis. Universal released it starring Steve Carell based on the true story of a man who is attacked. It's like a gay bashing on a man who is not gay. And it's a story I'd never seen told before. And it's also a fantasy. We were looking at trends. Five of my top 10 favorite films of the year in 2018 were fantasy films. The Nutcracker and the Four Realms. Christopher Robin, Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, Mary Poppins Returns, and Welcome to Marwen. So I love fantasy, and I think there were some great ones in 2018.
And how about documentaries? I think we had some very strong documentaries released this year. In particular, of course, Won't You Be My Neighbor, the documentary about Fred Rogers.
Oh. That's the kind of documentary that while you're watching it, you know it's one of the greatest documentaries ever made. Documentaries don't necessarily make money for the people who make them. They don't necessarily make a lot of box office. It's rare when anyone does become profitable in any way for anyone. They're really labors of love, but they tell great stories, and they, even more so than biopics or other stories that might sweep you into and cause tears or laughter, really can have great impact.
This was a good year, as you say, for documentaries. There are enormous numbers of documentaries being made, and my complaint about many of them is that somebody points a camera at an interesting subject and hopes for the best. They're often not very well made, but there were several this year. Won't You Be My Neighbor is the outstanding one. RBG, the Ruth Bader Ginsburg film, coming in at a close second. I also liked the movie called Yitzhak about the violinist Yitzhak Perlman. I don't even know if it opened in Milwaukee. But that is a very well-made documentary about an extremely interesting person. So the documentary form is alive and well. It's important in a way that we get something that is factual content. It's kind of maybe the fiber of our film-going diet, perhaps, in a way. And a film like the Mr. Rogers one was very moving and a symbol of hope, I think, for where we might go as a world.
How about one more top film from each of you?
Well, The Favorite. I find many people don't like that movie. It did get nominated for an Oscar. People go to it thinking it's going to be a comedy. It is funny, but it's not Wedding Crashers. I mean, it's not what people think of as comedy. The Masterpiece Theater crowd would find it to be, it's not quite the Downton Abbey cup of tea kind of thing, even though it crosses over into that. I think it was very ambitious trying to market the film to a mass audience. I hope it finds a larger audience in time. It had a very unique sensibility visually. It tells a very different kind of story within the kind of traditional, you know, British period setting, which I enjoy anyway, but that would be my number two.
I'd have to say Mary Poppins Returns, just because I love musical genre, and it is a kind of musical that we haven't seen in decades. It lacked that realistic edge that many modern movie musicals use to justify their production in the last several decades. So Mary Poppins Returns really, you know, it's a Time Gone By that's been reborn, and Lin-Manuel Miranda brought so much to it. Emily Blunt filling the shoes of Julie Andrews in a way that you could never imagine, you know, being done otherwise. That was just an outstanding film.
Any films that left a bad taste in your mouth?
Peppermint, Mile 22,
ironically,
Sicario, Day of the Soldiers. I don't like softcore violence porn, and all three of those movies fall on the low end of that for me.
You know, I'm such a film cheerleader. It's hard for me to pick, but I'm gonna be controversial here and say Roma, because it is one of the most celebrated films of the year, and I hated it. I think it is beautifully shot. Alfonso Cuarón is one of my favorite directors. I love all of his previous work, but this film I just couldn't have cared less about. I was very bored during it. I felt like my time, it was kind of like it ended, and I was like, oh, there's some time in my life I'll never get back. So that's just me, and you know, I'm not saying I'm right. It's just where I stand with that
Well,
film.
I actually agree with you, though I wouldn't go as far as say I hated it. It wouldn't make the worst film of the year list for me, but I was bored. Yeah. Beautiful to look at, kind of interesting, but not that interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, so good luck on Oscar night with it, but I don't think it's going to make it.
All right. Well, hopefully our listeners and fellow movie viewers maybe agree or disagree with some of these things, but we will certainly chat again next time about Oscar nominations. But for now, thank you both for coming in to talk about the best of.
Thank you, too.
Ryan Jay is a nationally syndicated radio host and the resident reviewer for TMJ4's The Morning Blend and Saturday News. Dave Lurson is the arts and entertainment editor for The Shepherd Express. They are both regular Lake Effect contributors, and you can hear more of their film segments with Audrey at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air is next. It is 11 o'clock.